The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that this panel of the court today is hearing oral arguments by video. Our basic rules and protocols are essentially the same. Each party will have 15 minutes for his or her principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You should see a time clock on your screen on one of the tiles if you're using the gallery view or the like. If you can't see it, you may wish to adjust your settings so that you can see all of the video screens that are connected to this Zoom argument. I will begin now by calling and the court has four cases on its calendar today, but only two with oral argument. The other two cases will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. So I will now call case number one. That's case number A24-1681, In re the matter of the welfare of the children of PMRS and RE. We have one appellant in this appeal. I believe we will hear oral argument from only one respondent's counsel who has filed a responsive brief. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce and identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. My name is Matthew Francis, Wheaton, Minnesota, attorney for appellant Paige Melminger. Just a quick note, if the court looks at me looking over to my right, your left during this proceedings, because I have another computer screen to my right with some of the pleadings that are on there for easier view. So forgive the distraction. I first want to start off my argument, Your Honor, by just noting that this is a case that this court should reverse what the district court did and remand this case back down for a trial. First, there was wholly inadequate best interest findings in this case. That's by two factors. First, the mother never admitted that it was in her children's best interest for her parental rights to be terminated. She never said this on the record. She never put it into her affidavit. Rule 5603, subdivision 4A says that there must be a full admission to all the statutory grounds in order for a valid termination to occur. And a best interest factor is part of those grounds. And that was not here today, or not here on that day. I would also note that the district court made a clearly erroneous finding of fact that appellant had admitted that she believed it was in the children's best interest for that to occur. The only reference she made to best interest in her allocution during the hearing was that she wanted her children to be with her mother and not the foster care parents. And I would argue this is no different than a criminal plea petition where you need to satisfy every element. As I cited a State versus Iverson in my petition, there's a huge liberty interest in keeping children for a parent rather than being incarcerated. And I think if we afford that to a criminal defendant, we need to have as high, if not a higher, standard for a parent who is terminating their parental rights. Secondly, there's a grossly inadequate findings of fact. All we have in the court's findings of fact were merely conclusory statements. 54.8.04, subparagraph C2. Double I says that the court is required to make a specific finding of fact that terminations in the children's best interest. The DLD case that I cited in my brief says a district court must explain.
Mr. Francis,
Yes, Your
it's
Honor.
hard on Zoom, right,
Yes.
to stop.
Oh, sorry.
I was looking at the consent and I looked at case law. I've been unable to find an appeal from a voluntary termination of parental rights. The cases cited either were after trial or where there was a stayed TPR that the stay was lifted and a termination was entered. Are you aware of any cases where it's a voluntary termination?
No, Your Honor, this is a case of first impression.
And in that regard, when I read through the consent, your client at the time of signing the consent did not dispute any of the factual determinations that the judge made.
Are you saying that she did not on the record make an argument that object to anything during the allocution hearing?
That and by way of the consent that she signed.
Correct. I would say that that is accurate, Your Honor. There was not an objection from her counsel at the time of the hearing, nor was there a what do you call it? When she filed her affidavit or her consent, she was agreeing that there was good cause. But I would also state, just like a criminal proceeding, where you have a defendant who can come in and say, yes, I'm going to plead guilty today, but you still have to have that defendant enter an admission to every element of the offense. And if they don't do that, even if they're there to plead guilty, it's an inadequate plea. And that's counsel, what we have here. Yes, Your Honor.
This is Judge Larkin. I recognize that termination proceedings have been called quasi-criminal, but they're not criminal. Do you have any case law saying that the standards that govern the validity of a guilty plea apply here in this context as well?
I do not, Your Honor. Just like Judge Riley said that this is, you know, about the voluntary consent appeal, this is a case of first impression. And I would argue to the court, as I stated a few seconds ago, that a person has a greater liberty interest in being a parent than they do in their freedom. I think if you would ask a parent, would you rather go to jail or keep your children? I would like to think above 95% would say, I want to keep my kids.
Counsel, that argument's been made in many cases in the context of constitutional arguments, and I think it's been rejected. I'm looking at a case from 1982 in the matter of the welfare of KT, also known as DLC. That does appear to be a voluntary termination case in which the court said two things. Court may terminate parental rights with the written consent of the only known parent when said parent desires such termination and evinces good cause for such adjudication. A final termination can only be set aside upon a showing of fraud, duress, or undue influence. We find no such showing. I note that in that case, appellant argued, and this is at page 16, that the document representing her written consent was invalid. She contends that the document does not meet the statutory formalities required by Minnesota statute, but she did not raise this issue below at either the termination hearing or the evidentiary hearing. It's well settled that a party may not raise for the first time on appeal a matter not presented to the court below. Even if the objection were timely, it is without substance because the statute, which governs voluntary proceedings for termination of parental rights, requires only written consent without prescribing any particular formalities. It does seem like you're asking for many more requirements than have been recognized in case law.
Your Honor, I've not had the opportunity to review that case, and obviously I'll trust the court's interpretation of that. What I will say that is noted in there that talks about formalities. Best interest of the child is not a formality. That is one of the, you know, as the statute says, the paramount consideration in all child protection proceedings.
But so that's the court's paramount consideration. And what I wonder is it necessary for the parent to make a best interest admission, or is it only necessary that the record includes evidence that indicates that the judge made that determination? I'm also looking at welfare of DCM, a case from our court, 1989. In a proceeding for voluntary termination of rights, there must be sufficient evidence to support a finding of good cause, the best interest of the child, and an attempt to reunite the family. Does that evidence have to come from the parent who's executing the voluntary consent?
Yes, it absolutely does. Because if they're given,
why is that? You say yes, it absolutely does. What rule or statute says it absolutely does, and that the district court can't, you know, look at the record and factual findings it's made, etc.?
Because the parent is giving a consent. I mean, if you're going to have a valid consent, like that's why I make the analogy to a criminal proceeding, even though they are different, you are still entering a consent. If you're entering a consent, you have to admit to everything. And it does say that it has to be a full admission. What's the rule? In 5804, it says it has to be a full admission.
Full admission to what? Could you read the rule to us, please?
Sure. It says it has to be a full admission to all of the statutory grounds. And best interest.
And what rule is that? Why that's confusing me is because the case law is quite clear that if a parent wants to voluntarily terminate, there do not have to be statutory grounds for involuntary termination. That's why I'm a little confused by the rule, because That rule seems to be talking about involuntary termination grounds, and the case law specifically says those need not exist for a parent's voluntary cons or parent's consent to a voluntary termination to be valid.
Well, I thought 5603 is an admission. So that's a voluntary, but not an involuntary, Your Honor.
But
And go
it's
ahead.
the rule on admissions.
Right.
Was this pleaded as a voluntary termination case?
Yes. That's the whole point of this. This is a consent to a voluntary termination, and I'm saying it's inadequate that since my client didn't enter an admission. To that there, I'm sorry, and entered an admission that it was the best interest of the children that her parental rights be terminated.
My understanding was that it was filed as an involuntary, and then there was a settlement conference held. And at the settlement conference,
Oh.
your client and the county reached an agreement that she would voluntarily terminate, is my understanding of the procedural posture.
I
So the
misinterpreted Your Honor's question. I thought you were asking what the end result was, not the petition.
No, because what I'm saying is you're citing a rule that talks about the need to admit all the statutory grounds in a pleading. And those aren't the circumstances here. We don't have a pleading alleging there should be a voluntary termination because A, B, C, D, she needs to admit A, B, C, D. She just did a voluntary termination as a way to avoid involuntary, which happens dozens of times every day in courts across Minnesota. And a lot of what you're saying is just not consistent with case law.
But how can you separate an admission under 5603 from a voluntary termination from a parent
Because we've
willing?
got a statute that says termination can be granted on two grounds. One, a parent can voluntarily consent, alleging that or admitting that there's good cause,
Right.
or based on all these other statutory grounds. They are two different things, two
But
very different things.
well, see, I would disagree with Your Honor. I said 5603 is how you get that admission entered.
But it's not an admission. It's a consent to voluntary termination. An admission implies you've got a criminal charge. You've got a petition requesting involuntary termination. You're going to admit to the other side's pleading. That's not what happened here. The other side didn't submit a pleading saying there should be a voluntary termination. This is something mother proffered on her own. I don't know that there necessarily needs to be anything to admit to. I
Well,
mean,
Your Honor.
can't a parent go into court and say, I want to voluntarily terminate my parental rights? Here's my consent in writing saying why I think there's good cause to do so. It's the parent's not admitting to an allegation against the parent. The parent is simply putting in writing what the parent wants to voluntarily do.
Yes, but they have to make an admission that there's good cause to terminate their parental rights. So that, and that in 5603 is captioned admission. So they do have to make an admission. I don't see grammatically, or if that's not the right word, but definitionally, that there's a distinction between a consent to an admission. You are still engaging in saying, I want to do something, and here's the reasons why I want to do it. And when you say these are the reasons why I want to do it, you have to lay out a statutory basis for that and follow the rules. And the rules say you need a full admission to what you are consenting to.
Mr. Francis, I'm just looking at the rule as we're talking, but the rule talks about written admission of the statutory grounds in at least two places. And I think there may be times where a parent will admit the statutory bases, admit that those have been proved, but yet still oppose termination for other reasons, such as best interest or perhaps reasonable efforts. I'm just wondering, I haven't had a chance to study the rule carefully, but
Right.
I think it's very possible that that rule does not refer to the entire concession of termination, but merely to referring to admission of the statutory grounds that are alleged.
But good cause is a statutory
I
grounds.
would agree with Judge Johnson that the statutory grounds are the children have been in out-of-home placement for longer than the statutory period, which is what happened here, regardless of how you count the days. And she then goes on to say, so she admits that statutory ground. She then goes on to say that she really wants her mom to be able to adopt the children. But in paragraph 24, she says, I'm not evading child support, but I want to facilitate the court's permanent placement of the minor children. And that she's doing so with full knowledge of what she's saying. So I would read grounds as being they're an out-of-home placement. Reasonable efforts haven't corrected the grounds for the prior or for the removal of the children, those sorts of things. Egregious harm, we don't have that here, but I think the grounds are the statutory grounds as Judge Johnson referenced. Why are we wrong?
I think you're wrong because a statutory grounds is good cause. I mean, that's in the statute.
Well,
So,
she admitted good cause. She
right.
consented to a finding of good cause and then she didn't. So why doesn't Thiel v. Stitch apply to your issues with regard to the erroneousness of these factual findings?
Because you still need to have a best interest finding. You still, the court has to make that and has to come from a parent admitting it. That's my argument here, is that this is, again, no different than a criminal proceeding that a parent has to do that. And that should be part of the elements. And if it's not, there's no case law talking about it. This is a case of first impression. And I'm asking this court, as a matter of logic, that we would, if we're requiring that of a criminal defendant, we certainly should be asking that for a parent to be giving up their parental rights on a voluntary basis, even on an involuntary basis. And that even gets over to crosses over to the inadequate findings of fact of that the district court made. I mean, there's nothing here but conclusory statements. There is no analysis that was requ as required under DLD and Tangi. She didn't say anything about the
Were
interest.
those voluntary consents, those cases?
DLD, I don't recall if it was. Tangi, I don't believe it was. So I understand the, but in JRR, that was, I believe, a voluntary consent case, and the court there made specific issues as to what you're supposed to find on behalf of a child before, I'm sorry, what you're supposed to find with respect to best interests. And we don't have it here. Just because a parent is admitting does not alleviate the court of its requirement to say this is in the best interest of the child, because there could obviously be many reasons why a parent would want to terminate parental rights and not it be in the best interest of the children. And it just wasn't done here. It wasn't done from, we focus most of the time here, and I know I'm over time, we focus most of the time here on a parent's consent, but the record as a whole is devoid of any evidence that needed that is required for the best interest. An In re ANT case is no way to evaluate under whether the record supports a district court's best interest evaluation, where there's only conclusory statements. And based upon that, it should be, you forget about the consent if you're not happy with that or satisfied with that argument. The record does not support the district court's findings that the termination of my client's children were in their best interest in this case, and it should be remanded, reversed, and remanded for a trial.
Thank you, Mr. Frenzies. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client at the outset, and then you may begin your argument.
Justin Anderson, Elba Lake, Minnesota. I represent respondent Western Prairie Human Services, which is a joint powers entity that provides social services in both Grant and Pope County. I guess I would like to take off where the questioning left off. In part two of appellant's reply brief, it seems that there is an intertwining of good cause and the best interest of the child, that they are inextricably linked and cannot be separated. In JRR, the court made a finding that if a district court finds that conditions for a voluntary termination of parental right exists, and I take that to read part one, and under the statute, it's clear that it has to be a written consent for good cause to terminate parental rights. So that's part one of the analysis, and we believe that the written consent is on file and there is no defect. And then the court has to consider the best interest of the child. And I think Judge Larkin got it right. Termination of parental rights cases are like making sausage. It's ugly work. This started out as an involuntary petition that had two bases. The parties mediated the agreement and reached an agreement that allowed the appellant here sufficient assurances that, there would not be the presumption of culpable unfitness that would affect another child's relationship, that would advocate for a communication and contact agreement moving forward after the permanent placement had been arrived at, to focus more closely on her mother as opposed to, the what might have been a concurrent placement. So there are a lot of moving parts in this. If you look at good cause, it is not defined by statute. It hasn't been really defined by the appellate courts, other than to say that it is a flexible standard that exists under a variety of circumstances. And if there were something more defined, it would be more difficult to resolve these matters, both to the satisfaction of the agency, the guardian ad litem, and the parents whose parental rights are at issues. It is a personal matter that may be properly based on a variety of facts and circumstances. So this case is just that case. It is one in which mom was facing a involuntary termination that would have affected her rights with the children that were the subject of this petition and another child that she has, and an agreement was reached. With respect to the best interest factors, I would also like the court to look at JRR. A lot of focus in appellant's argument is based upon what was in the consent. That case was actually a voluntary termination case that was reversed. By this court back in 2020, because the best interest factors were not met, and it looked at a variety of things. It looked at the fact that both the child's attorney and the guardian ad litem equally protested that it was in the best interest of the child. There were conclusory statements, but that court also observed the dearth of information in the TPR file. And in this case, the court made various orders that led up to the termination regarding the prior out-of-home placements, the services that were offered, everything that had been done with respect to the case plan. Perhaps anticipating one argument from Mr. Franzese with respect to the KT case about fraud, duress, or undue influence. A significant amount of the briefing dealt with a suggestion that appellant may have been misled as it relates to the timelines. I would suggest that 260C 503 1A does tell us how to calculate it, and if the children are out of the home for 12 months in the past 5 years, that a petition is required. I do not read it as the respondent does, and I would ask that the court focus on subdivision 3B, which tells us first how we calculate it, and it continues on that it gives the court an option if it is in the best interest of the child and for compelling reasons to extend the total time the child may continue out of the home under the current petition for an additional 6 months. And that language under the current petition contemplates that we are going to be having a petition regardless. I do not think that 256C is incongruent. with 260C301 subdivision 1B4. It was B5 at the time that this matter was originally pled out. There are a variety of statutory grounds, and there were multiple grounds listed in the original petition.
Counsel,
So,
I have a question. This is Judge Larkin. I was looking at the best interest issue. The district court's order contains a paragraph that sets forth the three factors that are must be considered when determining a child's best interest and concludes that the child's best interests are served by the termination, citing the testimony of mother and guardian ad litem. Were statements made on the record at the hearing? Explaining people's position on all of this? If so, were they under oath? What is the district court referring to when he says the testimony of mother and the guardian ad litem?
I don't know that there is a lot of testimony from mother in regards to the best interest of the child. As Your Honor alluded to, there was no protest, no questions of the guardian litem, who was sworn under oath, who participated in the mediation that led to the ultimate resolution here. Especially as to the first two prongs, I think it was generally acknowledged by the court without protest by any party that the child had an interest in preserving the parent-child relationship, and the mother, of course, had an interest in preserving that as well. That is,
Did the guardian then offer a statement under oath saying, here's why I think this is in the best interest of the kids?
yes, the guardian opined that it was in the child's, it was not in the child's best interest to continue the parent-child relationship, noting safety, stability, and permanency. The
So
fact
there's
that the
record evidence supporting a best interest finding. The complaint here appears to be mother didn't make that admission. Is that an accurate statement of where we are procedurally?
Yes, that is correct. I would also note that, following the emergency protective care hearing, the court issued an order, I believe, that was in my addendum, where it found, previous child protection involvement about neglect and substance abuse, mother's lack of cooperation, significant services that were previously provided, and her continued use of chemicals. And in its order attached to appellant's addendum, with respect to extending the permanency timelines, the court noted that further removal and lack of stability is not in the best interest of the children. The lack of stability and continued removals is
Counsel, I
very.
have another question for you.
Yeah.
The my research indicates, there are some cases where voluntary terminations are challenged, and where they're challenged by a parent, it's generally seeking to set aside the consent, fraud, duress, not knowing and intelligent. Otherwise, there are cases where the other side has said you should not allow the parent to terminate parental rights. Is that a fair generalization of what case law we have on in this area?
Yes, I would agree with that. To go a step further, I know that appellant argues that there weren't findings of reasonable efforts, and I researched as much as I could, and I found no voluntary admission case where reasonable efforts were even addressed. So, as this case may be, I do believe that the consent is valid. It was not challenged. Certainly, a better record could have been made in all of these regards. But if a court takes a look at the transcript, this was a very emotional decision for Miss for the appellant. And I earnestly believe that both the consent was for good cause for the reasons stated herein, and in the briefing, and that the court throughout the, at the hearing in which the consent was proven up, as well as in previous findings, that the best interest factors were adequately addressed.
Mr. Anderson, just I want to make sure I understand the extent of the district court record, because I'm looking at the mother's written consent. It's a 6-page affidavit at addendum 28 to 33, dated October 4 of 2024. And I just want to be clear, am I correct? There's nothing on file after that date where mother changes her position on these issues and files it with the district court. I mean, am I correct in understanding that the contrary arguments that consent is invalid, and so on, that good cause is not established, those are just solely made in the appellate papers?
Yes, there was no request for a new trial or motion to withdraw the consent. The next filing after the court's order to terminate would have been the notice of appeal, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
With that, I don't believe that I have anything further, and I would end my comments at this time. Thank you.
Judge Johnson, you're muted.
I apologize. I just said thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Franzese, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may proceed. You are still muted.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors. Based upon the what I want to focus on again is the statutory, or is the record in the district court's order where she made a finding of best interest of the child. As Mr. Anderson talked about, well, we have testimony from the guardian ad litem. If you look at pages 16 and 17 of the transcript, all she says is she notes the length of time the children have been out of the appellant's care, but then she also noted the children are deserving of permanency and stability. And mother is put in this case, and mother has in this case put the children's well-being needs and safety and permanency needs before her own. That's it. That's a conclusory statement. That is not a adequate statement for best interest in this matter.
So I presided over many cases challenging best interests. Those are the types of statements that are traditionally accepted as satisfactory to support a best interest determination. Do you have any case where, we said, well, these statements that you made in support of a best interest determination are too conclusory?
I put in there, well, the JRR case talks about, you're not about lack of conclusory statements.
Was
Says
that
that
having to do with best interest findings?
it says the record contains very limited information actually addressing the children's best interests. You're supposed to have an analysis here and a balancing of the children's. Why is this in the children's best interest? What stability are they lacking? What permanency is needed? How did the mother put her well-being? Just because she said that she will consent? That's not adequate enough. We're supposed to.
My
Go ahead, Your Honor.
understanding of the judge's TPR order is that a number of factual allegations listed in the petition were incorporated into the order.
Correct. And that was part of my reply brief when that was noted by Mr. Anderson in his brief. If the court looks at this, an unpublished decision from 2020 from this court, In Re Welfare of the Child of SJH. You can't admit or use factual allegations in a petition unless there's a stipulation to the parties to admit the petition as evidence. That didn't happen here. There was no mention of it during the hearing at all. It was just the court made a inserted that into her order after the hearing was over. So I believe based on that case law, in without an admission or a stipulation, the court cannot consider the allegations in the petition. They remain allegations. And that's another reason why this record is wholly inadequate to support a best interest finding. And but again,
Just
going back,
Mr. Fr Mr. Fr oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Fran. I want to
go ahead.
go back to the issue of I guess whether these arguments were preserved by your client in the district court and whether they may be considered on appeal. You've made a comparison between this procedure and a guilty plea, and it is true that a defendant convicted by a guilty plea may challenge the validity of the plea for the first time on appeal. I think the reason why that is allowed is because it's constitutionally required by the case law, starting with Boykin versus Alabama by the U.S. Supreme Court, that it's a constitutional right to have a valid guilty plea, so there doesn't need to be a motion to withdraw the plea necessarily. I guess if we were to analogize further, I'm wondering, is there any constitutional case law that you're aware of specifically on point that says, that a parent has a constitutional right not to have his or her parental rights terminated based upon an invalid consent and therefore may raise that directly?
I did not re research that issue for this case, Your Honor. I have in the past, I know, researched that issue and made arguments to this court about constitutional rights of parents to their own children. I know a Minnesota statute. I forget it. I'm a homeschooling parent, so I know that there's a statute in there that talks about about the relationship between a parent and a child, and that focuses more on the parent's ability to educate their child. But as far as a constitutional right, I cannot tell you at this point in time, cite to anything because I just haven't researched it. But I believe that it is there based upon past research and past knowledge from other cases. So it's I and I think it's again, I don't mean to be insulting or anything to the court, but I think it's just common sense that a parent's right to their child has got to be treated. And I know it's not, your honors do treat it very seriously, and it's a
But
great.
I understood. But you're asking us to make. What we have in the district court record is that 6-page consent form that she filed, and your appellate brief is, it's contrary to that affidavit of your client in the record. So I mean, we have. I mean, ordinarily, like in the KT case, I think it's that Judge Larkin mentioned, also DDG of the Supreme Court, 1997. In both of those cases, the appellants filed a motion to vacate in the district court, reflecting the change of position, and asked the district court to change its order because of the parent's change of position. And I'm not aware of any, like Judge Larkin, not aware of any appeal where a parent has changed his or her position and come directly to the court without making such a motion to the district court.
Right.
So I mean, it's isn't it? I mean, we're really in an odd position if we're trying to evaluate your arguments in light of a district court record, which is contrary to your arguments.
Well, Your Honor, I'll first say I was not the attorney of record at the district court level. And then, when my understanding, when I researched the issue, was that in order for us to do a vacation motion, it would have had to been done before the court entered its order. And that's why I did not do a vacation motion myself before filing this appeal. If that answers the court's question.
Okay.
So that's the only explanation I can give. What's the
What
explanation?
authority says it has to be before it,
I was,
what authority says it has to be before the court issues its order?
Your Honor, I'm not, again, I don't have that in front of me. I just remember when I researched this issue, that's a conclusion that I made, and that's the reason why I did not file a post-trial motion. Otherwise, I certainly would have, given Judge Johnson's statements.
Rule 22.02 says dot 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 the court may relieve a party from a final order or proceeding for the reasons of mistake, fraud,
Oh,
etc.
right. And that's why, Your Honor, I did not, in my analysis and conversation with my client, I did not have, I mean, to have that mistake, fraud, or duress, it has to be an extreme. It has to be a threat that is made. It has to be something really over the line. And that just didn't happen here. All parents are under stress in a sense of duress when they're entering a consent.
As I
But
read further, I see the rule says motion shall be made within a reasonable time, but not more than 90 days following the order. It
correct.
seems like a Rule 22 motion could have been brought.
Well, again, Your Honor, I have to make a finding that, or make a finding. I have to believe that my client's admission was based upon fraud or duress. And the case law indicates that that's a very, very high standard to show. And it didn't exist in this case. All parents are under some form of duress when they enter these consents. But there wasn't any fraud here. And I could not show adequately to the district court and such a motion that my client was threatened in any way, that she was lied to, that she was, you know, something that met the standard from existing case law. And
Judge
that was
Johnson, may I ask another question?
Yes, you
I
may.
Know we'll pass,
yes.
but
nope, nope, please feel free.
Mr. Frenzies, I appreciate your candor as to why you didn't bring that motion. But as I've listened to all this, it seems to me that what this perhaps comes down to is whether or not, when we're assessing whether there was good cause, best interest, reasonable efforts, we can look at the entire record. So, you know, findings of fact, statements made under oath, et cetera, or does the parent who's consenting have to specifically meet those things by analogy to a criminal case? I mean, is that the thrust of your argument? That we can't look at anything other than your parents, your client's written consent to determine whether or not there were reasonable efforts, best interests, and good cause?
No, is it both, Your Honor? The first step would be look at what, in other words, I think you can look at what my client said as well as what happened on the record during the hearing. So if my client gives an adequate consent form, I think that ends the analysis there. It's not a valid consent, and therefore the termination should not go forward. So
okay, that didn't make sense to me. I'm sorry.
Okay,
I perhaps
that's okay.
Didn't understand the answer. You're not saying your client's consent was invalid as duress, fraud, or not knowing and intelligent. You're
Correct.
Saying your client's written consent did not adequately address why termination, why there was good cause for voluntary termination, why there had been reasonable efforts, and why termination was in the child's best interest. Are you saying
Right.
the only thing we can look at to determine whether the judge's findings on those factors was sufficient is your client's affidavit, or may we also look at the broader record, that is any evidence that was presented at the hearing or in written reports, which your client did not challenge?
I would say you're supposed to look first at my client's affidavit or consent. If
may
there
we
was,
also look at the broader evidentiary
right.
record that was created at the hearing or in the proceedings?
If there's something that contradicted an omission or a lack of finding, like I'm arguing here, in other words, she didn't have a best interest consent in her affidavit. If she at the hearing said, I consent, then I would not have, or I'm
not
sorry.
I'm not asking about evidence from your client. I'm asking
right.
about evidence from the child protection worker, evidence from the guardian ad litem, evidence in the form of reports that were submitted to the court, prior factual findings made by the district court in the same case.
Right.
Okay. Can the court look to something other than your client's written consent and written and testimony at the hearing and or written state written or oral statements at the hearing?
Right. No. If
okay.
it's an if it's an adequate
and why is that? And you get to that answer by saying because it's analogous to a criminal proceeding.
Correct.
If we reject that proposition, what's your support for your position that we can't look at anything other than admissions or statements, oral or written, from your client?
Right. If you reject that, then you do look at the whole record from the transcript and the court's written order. Correct.
The final question I have about your analogy, and I don't know if it's a question or just sort of what I'm struggling with, is this.
Sure.
Criminal case, we agree what the standards are. The state charges second degree assault. The state says we're willing to settle for third degree assault. The state actually has to amend its pleadings. Then the defendant admits those pleadings. Is there anything that requires the state, when it agrees to go from an involuntary TPR to a voluntary, to amend its pleadings to assert voluntary grounds to which your client admits? Or, go ahead.
No, I say, I believe it did in this matter amend on the record that it went from a involuntary petition to a voluntary and allowed my client to consent.
Okay. So there was just an oral amendment saying we'd agree to a voluntary.
Correct.
But did the state actually say, and here are the reasons why voluntary is, I get, here's what I'm struggling with in your analogy. There are cases in which the state's not even involved. A parent goes to court and says, I want to terminate my parental rights. Here are my reasons for doing so. And I believe that happens even though the state's not in any way, shape, or form involved. So, I mean, the analogy to a criminal case in which the state is always involved and initiates the action is somewhat troubling to me.
But there still needs to be best interest finding, even in when a parent does it without the
I
counsel.
understand that, but the district court made a best interest finding. You're saying it was inadequate and it was conclusory, but the district court's order addresses the best interest factors, it addresses reasonable efforts, and it addresses good cause, which is what's required under the case law.
And
You're
Judge
just
Johnson, may I just make an observation after Judge Larkin is done?
Yes, of course. We will have time for all judges' questions.
Judge Larkin?
Yes, I'm
I'm
done.
sorry, done. I was just going to say both attorneys acknowledged that this was a very emotional hearing, and I read the transcript, and I was the judge in Hennepin County Juvenile Court for many years and also presided over a lot of these cases. And when a parent has agreed to voluntarily terminate their parental rights, and this judge acknowledged that this mother was showing her care and concern for her children by doing so, it would seem counterproductive, and I never did it, to say, well, you were a horrible parent because you abused meth, your baby was born meth positive, even after services were provided. Your domestic partner smothered one of the children. You wouldn't go through those at this juncture and put all of those reasons on the record. And so, if this record at this hearing is devoid of a lot of things that happen in a criminal trial, I would suggest that that's the reason.
Sure, Your
It's
Honor,
not
but
a question, it's a statement.
sure,
I know, and I'll
but
make a statement to follow up on that because, in addition to serving as the judge who provided over these cases, I defended parents in these cases for 13 years in Hennepin County. And I executed many voluntary consents. And I probably appreciate better than anyone how difficult it is for parents to do that and to make the admission that they're making the hardest decision in their life because they think it's best for their kids. To embark on a path of saying we need to make that process even more difficult for them by requiring them to admit what they're trying to avoid admitting by doing a voluntary consent doesn't make any sense to me. And I don't think that's consistent with the best interests of kids because what you're doing is taking us down a path where we're going to be doing termination trials when we don't need to be doing termination trials. And that's not in the best interests of kids.
Right, and it wasn't really even arguing that whether or not I think you're both talking about the issue of good cause, and I did not address that in either portions of my argument because it seems to be very subjective. And as your honors both said, is that when you start adding more facts to it, it can be that risk of what you're really just requiring a voluntary or an involuntary, even when it's voluntary. I understand that. I'm just suggesting that in this case, there needed to be more because it's a subjective standard that there needed to be more in this case than just what was given, particularly with my argument that I think there's a misconstruing of the 500 days and what that meant. And I will also just in a final statement, this was a situation too where my client was already engaged in services. She had set up appointments for relapse prevention, put on a sweat patch, set up visits for their kids, volunteered to take random UAs all on her own. So that goes back to my motion that there should have, or my appeal of the motion, the motion denying her the extension of the timelines because the case was filed before the timelines required this TPR to be done. And I
Well,
think
then,
that.
counsel, if that's the case, why couldn't you have moved to set this aside, not fraud or duress, just saying, well, it wasn't intelligent. She was of the belief that she had no more time. She didn't understand that there could have been more time.
Well, Your Honor, I think just because the overall factor here of what everybody else was looking at, well, I don't have a good answer to that, Your Honor. I think my focus was fraud or duress and not the intelligence part of it. So perhaps I could have, but that's why I brought it up during this proceeding here because it was something that everybody, in my opinion, was getting wrong. And based upon that, that's part of the reason why I think the district court denied my client's request for the extension when that request was made earlier in the proceedings. And there was time here, and she was doing, you know, it's one of the things I know you all agree, it's very difficult to do a termination when a client or a parent has a, you know, 14 months of very good behavior, they have a relapse, and now we're moving right away to termination, and sorry, you don't get a second chance. And that's why I'm thinking we need to really look and dig in at these records to make sure that there is a best interest standard, that it was adequately made on the record, and that the parent admitted that it was in the best interest of her child to give up those parental rights, which are very important. So I think, unless you have something else, I should end here, Your Honor.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you for the arguments of both counsel. The case was well argued. The case is now submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 45 days.
Thank you, Your Honors, very much.
Thank you.